The following is a part of the Radio Memphis On Demand service. It originally aired live on Radio Memphis and has been edited for time.
That's a little Tim Holtzman for you right here on Radio Memphis. You're hanging out with me, D, of Radio Memphis Around the World. How about that? Tim Holtzman, the song is called Monster. That is off his album, Get Loved. We've talked to him before right here on Radio Memphis. He actually called all the way in from Australia and had some fun with us. And I tell you what, for those of you that are down under, next week, that's going to be August the 20th, he is going to be playing at the Odyssey Tavern and Brewery in Mondonead, Australia. So you guys have an opportunity there, you can check him out. All right. Now it's time. You guys know what the deal is. It is actually a Radio Memphis Road Crew Radio Alert. All right. And of course, you guys know what that means when I tell you this, is that it's part of the Radio Memphis Road Crew Radio series brought to you by Kenbar Films. And what we're doing is that we're bringing more insight to the table for all of our emerging artists and entertainers by actually sitting down with some of the best industry pros that work behind the scenes. Okay. Think about that incredible record that you just purchased, or think about that awesome live show that you just saw, or even that fantastic event that you went to and you thought, oh my God, look at all this cool stuff, right? All right. So for this afternoon, all right, Saturday, August the 12th, we have a phone call that we're taking all the way in from Australia. And of course, you guys wondering who I'm talking about? Well, this 6-time Tech Award winner and 2-time Parnelli winner with more than 3,000 live event mixing credits is none other than Robert Scoville. Okay. He has been responsible for Front of the House, for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, for Rush, Def Leppard, Prince, Matchbox 20, and Alice Cooper. You guys are starting to see somewhat of a connection, right? Of course, along with a ton of other groups and bands. Now, when he's not behind the mixing desk, he actually also serves as a senior marketing specialist for Avid Technologies. And what he does is he focuses on developing their live console and their actual recording efforts. Now, what you may not know about Robert Scoville is that he was first inspired by music. He wanted to be like the drummer Mitch Mitchell and play for a group like Jimi Hendrix Experience. That is, until he was first introduced to the soundboard and behind the scenes around the age of 13, going on 14, and shortly after. After that, his mom agrees, okay, takes him to an Alice Cooper show. And of course, as soon as he saw what went down there, the rest is history. He was hooked. He was so hooked, in fact, he even worked for free for months for a company to get his foot in the door, okay? Now, with nearly 4 decades in the business, he is most definitely a pioneer of not only the sound industry, but also of the music business, okay? With his knowledge, you know, it comes a certain caliber of wisdom, and I want to be able to tap into that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull Mr. Robert Scoville on the phone with me right now. How are you doing, my friend?
I am doing awesome, Diana. How are you, girl?
I am fantastic. I am so fantastic. Thank you so much for stopping down and taking some time with me right here on Radio Memphis.
Hey, you know, I was listening to what you said there. Are you sure you've been reading about the right guy? You sure you got the right guy on the phone here?
Hey, man, I picked all the good stuff. Don't remember, I told you on the phone the other night that I sat down and I read through your blogs, too, and you got some really cool, juicy stuff. And I was like, all right, I'm going to make him look good first before we get into it.
And we appreciate that.
Not a problem. Honey, and for those of you that have tuned in, I'm talking to Mr. Robert Scoville. Look, you know, one of the biggest things, and I kind of told you about, you know, what we're doing, you know, with the Road Crew Radio series. And, you know, we had quite a laugh the other night on the phone because you've done so much. You're in the presence of so many incredible artists and, you know, and so many incredible companies, that the way that I was able to get to you was kind of off, you know, off the beaten path a little bit. I do want to give a big shout out and a big thank you to Putter. Because
my old friend Putter, man, I tell you what, he and I have kicked up some dust together, man.
Tom Hanlon was the one that, you know, as soon as we got done talking with him, he was the one that, you know, he called me up and he said, look, you need to talk to Robert. And I was like, I'd love to talk to Robert. And oddly enough, you know, and of course, you know how Tommy works. He got Ken Barr. he called Ken and goes, you call Robert and you tell Robert to call D. You know, it was real fantastic. And ultimately that kind of led us into, you know, us having this conversation and about you and about, you know, as far as what you do. And I think one of the beautiful things that I kind of appreciated was that Alice Cooper show is what hooked you into the sound world.
Yeah, that's a big piece of it, that's for sure. Yeah,
that's a very, very big piece of it. Now, as far as some of the things that you've done, you know, I want you to tell everybody, you know, ultimately, you know, how you really, really got started.
Well, I mean, you know, the story that I've told in the past, and it's the true story is, you know, really my attraction to the sound part of it really started at a Supertramp show. Supertramp had come to St. Louis, and they were playing a place called the Fox Theater in the early 70s.
Right.
And I was allowed to go to that. And, you know, luckily for me, I mean, I think I was very fortunate to have parents that were, you know, would allow me to go to concerts at a very young age. Because, I mean, concerts in 1970s, folks, were not like concerts today. I mean, it was an edgy experience. I mean, you were on the edge of the underground there. So
wow.
For them to allow me to go was really special. And then at this show, you know, I had been trying to be a musician up to that point. You know, I'd been taking lessons and playing in small bands up until that point.
Right.
But still didn't really know anything about audio or anything like that. And once I got to this show, I remember having pretty good seats down on the floor. And I remember just at some point during the show having this realization of, man, there is something else going on here besides the band just walking on stage and playing.
Wow.
And there's something else happening here, and I couldn't get my head around it because it sounded unbelievable. I mean, it sounded like I was just sitting right in the middle of a record, you know, and it was incredible. So as luck would have it, you know, as I was walking out, I walked right by the soundboard, right by the console, you know, and it kind of just struck me. I kind of stopped and looked.
Wow.
And you know, I know the guy that was mixing, you know, saw me, and he kind of picked up on the vibe a little bit. And, I mean, by the grace of God, whatever you want to call it, I mean, he looked at me and he goes, you want to come up and have a look around?
And that's all it took.
And he took me through the whole thing, you know. So, now, here's the funny part of this whole story, and I've told it a few times, and I never tire of telling that story.
Yeah.
But here's the cool part about it. I told this story in another interview, I don't know, it's probably been 3 or 4 months ago. And somehow a friend of mine, a really close friend of mine that I toured with in the 80s, saw and heard the interview in Norway.
Oh, wow.
And he knew who was mixing front of house for Supertramp at that point. He actually knew the guy. It's a guy named, oh my gosh, I'm getting spaces. I keep wanting to call him Nigel Pope, but it's not. It's Russell Pope. Thank
okay.
you very much. Russell Pope. And he knew him. So he reached out to him and told him the story, and Russell remembered it.
Oh, my goodness.
Then we reconnected on Facebook. So, you know, here I am conversing with the guy, you know,
who pretty
42
much
years later.
Oh, wow. Kind
of set me on my path. So it was just the greatest moment. That's when I kind of threw it all in. I just went, yeah, I'm a Facebook fan. I'm okay with Facebook.
Well, that is beautiful then, because I mean, you were able to kind of reconnect with somebody that set you on your path. And
oh my gosh, it was just the greatest thing ever, you know. And just the fact that he remembered it was just mind blowing to me. I mean, I think about all the, you know, all the shows I've done in my life, I couldn't tell you what I ate for dinner, you know.
but he remembered. But see, that's what's so beautiful about all of that. And you know, he's got to be proud as hell, because look what you've done. Look at all all the stuff you've jumped into, you know.
And you know, it's definitely I definitely took that as a motivation to pay it forward. You know, I mean, now it shows, and ever since then, it shows. If I see some kid or some teenager or some adult walk up and go, "What is all this? Come on up. I'm going to show you around." You know?
See, and that's what's so awesome about you. And for those of you that have tuned in, y'all, I'm talking to Robert Scoville, engineer extraordinaire. I appreciate you saying that, because you know there's been such a long period of time where, you know, individuals have been, you know, kind of really protecting their territory, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And you know, and they don't want anybody in, and they don't want anybody to take a look at stuff, and they don't want anybody to step in. And here you are. You're like flying the door open, going, "Come on, let me show you what I'm using."
Yeah, it's a confidence thing. I mean, it's a self-confidence thing, and kind of this sense of, it sounds fluffy to say it this way, but it's this sense of, look, I know what I'm doing. I know how to get what I want.
Right.
And just kind of showing you how the gear works is not the secret to that, you know.
That's perfect.
And it's like, you can come and hook things up and set all the settings exactly like I set them. Guess what? The show is not going to sound the same as when I'm doing it versus you're doing it.
Right.
It's a personality thing. You know, there's definitely a personality to all of this. Whether you're a musician or an engineer, same thing applies. The person is what makes the difference in it, not the technology.
And you are the first person, believe it or not, and that has come out and said it in that statement, Robert, that, you know, it's the personality, it's the person, you know, and you've made it, you know, you made technology, you know, you made knobs and you know, and gauges and things. You made them very human when you said that.
Yeah. Well, it's true. I mean, I think we can get blinded by it because it's so technologically complex and advanced. You know, we can have a tendency to kind of give credit to the ghost in the machine, and it's just not the case. I mean, it's exactly like painting to a degree. That's always the analogy I use. You know, the paintbrush doesn't paint the painting.
Right.
You know, the painter paints the painting. He just uses a really good paintbrush and really good colors.
Perfect answer.
All choices for him.
Perfect answer.
That's the analogy I always use.
Absolutely. And you know, and what's so funny, so this kind of, and you're so beautiful. I can tell you're doing this for a long time, man, because you still gave me the segue. So talking about, you know, your style and everything that you did, you did a very, very funny thing. Okay. So, you know, guy from Supertramp shows you the board, all right? Goes to the Alice Cooper show, you know, he's enamored. And which, by the way, the Alice Cooper show, when your mom takes you, you know, it was, I laughed when you told me about it, because your mother had no idea what she was taking you to. And
absolutely no idea. Trust me on this one. You know, when I get up in the morning as a 10 or 12 or 13 year old, there's country music on the radio station in the house. I mean, it was country and western 100% of the time, unless you were in my bedroom, and then it was all the other stuff.
Right.
You know, that was all she was ever exposed to. She probably thought Alice Cooper was a female performer, you know. I mean, you had no idea what it was.
I told you, and it was so funny because, you know, when you were telling me the story, you know, the other day on the phone, I had this whole Detroit Rock City, you know, scene in the movie in my head, you know, where that's your mom going, oh, no, we're not, repent. Well, so, that's what painted for me. But, you know, what was beautiful about it is that when you finally get the bug, okay, and you figure out that, you know, the soundboard and running front of the house and mixing and stuff, you're like, okay, I want in on this. You did something very peculiar, okay? You wound up actually, you know, picking up a gig, and you wound up working and doing something for quite some time.
Yep.
Now you want to talk about the, I believe the summer shows and stuff that you were doing.
Yeah, that all tied. Well, you know, I mean, it kind of got to tie it back to the Supertramp moment. You know, once I kind of saw that thing in play, then it was like, okay, well, how do I get to do that?
Mm-hmm.
How do I do that? I mean, this is 1974, folks. I mean, there's no school. There's nothing to teach you how to do it, you know, and it was just the most mysterious thing.
Right.
You know, and even my counselors at school, I was, you know, I remember bringing in like a Hit Parade or magazine or something that had a little bit piece about audio in it and saying, how do I do this? This is what I want to do. Give me the path, you know.
Right.
And the best we could come up with at that point was just go to electronic school. So I had enrolled in a technical college in Kansas City.
Okay.
To study toward an electronic engineering degree. And while I was there, luckily for me, there was a sound company also in Kansas City, who was a big regional powerhouse company, and they did these park series of concerts down in this area called Brush Creek, and it was a free concert every weekend, so they were looking for volunteers to come work it. Anyway, I mean, one week it might be the Kansas City Philharmonic, the next week it might be Pat Metheny, the next week Earth, Wind, and Fire. I mean, you know, or whatever, you know, I mean, or, you know, it could be anybody.
Sure.
And the city kind of sponsored them. So they were working at the highest level there, even though it was a free series. So I went, they put a post up on the bulletin board at school, and I went down and volunteered for the first weekend.
Okay.
As an energy-filled 19-year-old, you know.
Right.
And needless to say, they didn't call me back the next week, you know. We don't need any more kids down here.
I think that's the part that got giggled, because you're like, and they didn't call me back.
Because
yeah. I did good.
I mean, I'm sitting on the couch, you know, Saturday morning the following week, just thinking, why haven't they called? What's going on? I mean, I want to go to work. So I literally just grabbed my gloves and my hat and went down there and just joined in. It's like, you know, I knew what to do after 1 week. I was like, okay, I kind of know what to do. So I just joined in, and sure enough, I ended up doing that every weekend of that summer, probably May through all the way into, you know, September or something. You know, I mean, it was a ton of work.
Wow.
But the thing that was crystal clear to me after that first weekend was like, this is my road in. This is my path in right here. I can see it. I can absolutely see it sitting on the horizon in front of me. I know this is my path in here.
Wow.
So I just kept going, you know. And long story short, I won't drag it all the way out here.
Oh, yeah, we're going all
the
way there.
No,
don't you do that to me. Don't you cut out the good stuff. Nah.
By the end of the summer, you know, there, I think in the company, there was just this assumption that I was working there. Because I was showing up to prep all the gear now, you know, build out all the racks and everything else, you know, in the time leading up to the shows. Now, I was going in and doing that now. So there was this kind of assumption that I was actually working for the company, which I wasn't.
Not even on the payroll or anything.
Toward the end of the year, they're going to have the Christmas party. So, you know, of course, I'm invited to the Christmas party. And while I'm there, a couple of the principals of the company are there. And, you know, they're well-versed in who they're paying every week. And they kind of look at me and they go, do you work for us? I mean, they almost, I could see it in their eyes. They were thinking, is he crashing our Christmas party? Is this some outsider?
Well, I mean, there's that, or you work for them and they forgot you is what they're thinking.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's the other, because that's embarrassing.
All of that was in play, I assure you. So, you know, again, kind of long story short, you know, they kind of realized, oh my gosh, this guy has been putting in unbelievable hours, you know, so they decide they're going to hire me for the next year. But the Christmas thing was, they gave me an Anvil briefcase. In case you guys don't know it, Anvil is a road case manufacturer.
Okay.
And they make a briefcase that looks like a road case. I mean, it was just awesome. You know?
Wow.
And I remember being handed that thing. I mean, you might as well have been handing me the Oscar.
Oh,
you know, or a Grammy at that point.
Wow.
It was just the greatest thing ever. I just thought, oh man, I've arrived. I have absolutely arrived.
And you got it.
It was just the greatest moment. I'll take that to my grave. That whole night.
And you still have that briefcase?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah, I bet you do. That's you know, that was, oh, yeah. That was your first piece of validation that you showed up somewhere.
Right. Yeah. I'll pass that on to somebody someday.
Oh my! Is that like the magical? That's the magical briefcase. You're actually going to pass it to somebody?
Yeah. Well, think of it like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. You know, every time you open it up, it's a big gold glowing. You know,
are you gonna put like any like secret stuff in there, like secret codes or secret stuff that goes on the board, or you know, like look, if you always use.
Yeah, I'll put like a, you know, chicken bone cross, and a rabbit feet, and things like that. You know, just something to pass on the good luck. You know.
Oh my God! Well, see now I'm very intrigued. Okay, because. I'm going to have to really follow what you're doing, because I need to know who gets this briefcase, because that's like,
and
you know,
this could be our whole, we could start a whole website about this, you know, follow the briefcase.
It's this whole conspiracy thing. I mean, this is like the Jedi Master passes out, you know, who's the chosen one, you know, who's the chosen one, you know, and according to Robert Scoville, who's the chosen one? I had everybody freak out. Are you kidding? Oh, now we're going to have to do like, you know, do little codes and stuff, and do stuff like with the Matrix and stuff, and like you're going to have to get through these levels to get to it. Yes.
When you get a free ticket to enter at McDonald's and you buy a Happy Meal, that's when we know we will have arrived. That's when we've made it all the way.
We just made the whole promotion up right here on air from start to finish, including the company, the briefcase, and the conspiracy theory. Absolutely
okay,
brilliant.
Okay, Ryan, I had no idea we were going here today. All right, I'm just going to say, I had no idea we were going to talk about this.
Well, you know, look, this is what this is about. I want to be able to talk about stuff that nobody else is talking to you about. And so here's the thing, Robert. What's going to happen is that when we're done, you're going to lay back and you're going to, okay, bet money. You're going to look at that closet door that briefcase is inside of, and you're going to go, you know, she's on to something. And you're going to pull it out and it's going to be, oh, there's going to be a light. It's going to be like the Indiana Jones thing, you know, when they find, you know, the headpiece and, you know, and it's the ark and everything else. And yeah, I already know where this is going. And you're going to pull it out and you're going to go, who would I give
this
to?
You know, as I tour around the world, I'll just start leaving little clues in all the venues, you know. little Polaroids of it in places, you know, things like that.
That is fantastic. All right, so you've been bequeathed the briefcase.
Yes, and presented the golden briefcase.
The golden briefcase, and so you've arrived. Now, and at this
apparently
point
it worked.
Yeah. And apparently it worked because you're doing a fantastic job, really. Okay, I can reread the thing I read earlier if you'd like for me to. I'm just going to go ahead and throw that out there. You know, one of the things. So you get this, and at what point do you feel like you've gotten your big break? You know, for the like your big show, your big break that you feel like you're making an impact.
Oh well, I mean my first big break, honestly, and you know. I will be the first to sit here and that I have been the luckiest effing guy on this planet. I mean, I, there's something about being in the right place at the right time.
Perfect.
In my career story. No question about it. Now, I'll contrast that against, and it's something I preach to people that want to get into this business. You know, if you're going to play, I want to be in the right place at the right time game.
Right.
You want to play that to get into your career. The thing you have to take with you is you have to be ready when the time comes. You have to be prepared for it. It's too late to prepare once opportunity knocks. You know, that's one of my favorite kind of
yeah. You're right.
So I'm kind of an over prepper anyway. You know, so
most of you guys are the way, everybody that really kind of talk to, you know, and it's like, hey, what do you think about it? And every you know, you guys have like 10 steps down into like you know 5 years from now, and it's a
oh, yeah.
and it's a beautiful way to be.
It's a life chess match, no doubt about it. I mean, if you're not thinking at least 4 or 5 moves ahead, you're already behind the curve. I mean, there's just no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with living in the moment, but you got to be planning
right.
5 steps ahead. No
right.
question about it.
Right. So you show up, and first big band for you. I mean,
where I was heading with that was, you know, I was living in Kansas City at the time, and there was a band just breaking out of Kansas City. Called Shooting Star.
Sure
there are listeners out there that know this band. I mean, they were, I've always accused them of being the biggest band I ever worked for that never made it. You know, they were just, they had pockets of just enormous success around the United States and even in outside the world a little bit. So
right.
they were just coming off of their first record that they had done in London. A guy named Gus Dudgeon produced it, infamous producer, an incredible producer.
Okay.
And it was a great record. I mean, absolute great record. And they got great traction on it. And they were kind of coming in the studio. I was working moonlighting at a little studio in Kansas City along with the live sound work. And they came in to kind of do their demos. And lo and behold, you know, I worked with them a little bit there. And then they go out to do a show. I'm going to say it's maybe in Wichita or something like that. I can't remember exactly. And, of course, Superior Sound
right.
is going to be the sound company. So I got to hook up with him again, and we kind of started doing this little dance relationally, you know, and I could kind of tell when they got ready to go on the road, there was a good chance they were going to ask me to come with them.
Oh, wow.
And sure enough, they did. So I went out as the monitor mixer on the tour, and also because I was a drummer, I think, more than anything, and
okay.
because I knew drums really well, they asked me to also be the drum roadie. So I was doing drums and mixing monitors for them, and I worked for them for a period of years, and In the course of doing that, I mean, not only were they doing big headline shows, but they were also, you know, they were opening for ZZ Top,
Jeff oh, wow.
Starship,
yeah.
Journey. I mean,
yeah.
And luckily I was smart enough, I guess is the right way to put it, smart enough to network all those connections. Like, you know, by the end of that first year I had worked with them, my gosh, I'd worked with every major sound company. We've been in tons of great gigs. I mean, it's like, you know, my foot was clearly, you know, my hip was through the door at that point. So,
wow.
It was just a matter of, you know, playing those connections and getting to the next step of it. That's where the chess match starts, you know, where you start thinking 3 or 4 steps ahead there.
Well, I mean,
so it was an incredible break. I mean, an incredible break.
Of course it was.
Believe me, at that point in Kansas City, there wasn't a lot of music coming out of Kansas City at that point, you know.
No, there wasn't.
At that level. So that was a huge break for me. Huge break.
That is a fantastic break. You know, when I sit there and I think about all of the stuff, because, you know, one of the other things, and for those of you that have tuned in, you know, I'm Robert Scoville. You you make the mention, you know, of you know, the networking thing, of course, and you make the mention of, you know, of getting with everybody. And ultimately, you know, at the end of the day, you know, not only do you have to bring your game, and not only do you have to be, you know, kind of on point with what you've got going on, but, you know, you also are you know, dubiously making these relationships. And, yeah. And you know, and at the time, it's so funny because, you know, when you guys were all doing this, I mean, you're the pioneers. You're the pioneers of everything. And I think one of the things you said to me on the other day, on the other night on the phone, was that, you know, you were doing sound when sound wasn't even sound. You know, it was one of those where there wasn't even like, there wasn't even a thing for that yet, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was really still a very, I mean, to call it a cottage industry would be a little bit of a stretch, you know? I mean, there were a handful of companies around the world that were specializing, you know, in large format, large scale live sound, but it was very rare. I mean, there were very, very few of those, 3-4 companies around the world that were doing it. And lots and lots and lots of regional companies. And the technology in and of itself was very rudimentary. I mean, it was very simplistic. But again, you know, I kind of have a tendency to always kind of look at the glass, you know, half full. And, you know, I look back on that, and because it was so simple, you had to be really, really grounded in fundamental audio. You had to understand audio from the very fundamental aspect of it.
Yes, you do.
You were going to have to get every inch out of everything you ever did with every piece of technology you had. I mean, you had to use it to its fullest potential, without doubt.
Yes, you do. And that's a perfect thing. And I'm glad you said that. What I'm going to do is I need to stop down. I need to take a quick commercial break. But you just set me up for the next moment. So let me do this. For those of you that are tuned in, you're tuned into Radio Memphis Around the World with me, Dee. And I am actually in the middle of a Radio Memphis Road Crew Radio Alert radio interview with Mr. Robert Scoville. And, of course, I'm going to go even further. And no, we're not done. I'm still intrigued by the briefcase. I'm now all bets are off with you, man. I'm going to start digging with you, so I just want you to know that, okay?
Well, I'll entice you with this. The Alice Cooper connection doesn't stop where it's already stopped. It actually goes on and has a bigger impact later.
So, oh, I know it does.
I'll tell you the rest.
I know it does, and we're going to bring that back around because things apparently do come full circle. And for those of you that are hanging out with me, you guys, hold tight. We'll be back with some more Robert Scoville right here on Radio Memphis Around the World. That's a little Hannah Fairlife for you right here on Radio Memphis. You're tuned into Radio Memphis Around the World with me, Dee, Sign of the Times. And that is off her latest album, A Bright Future. You know, speaking of engineers, you guys, you know, I always had to bring this up because I also had a fantastic time on air talking with him. And that was done by Mr. Michael Wagner, you know, at Wire World Studios. And so that's definitely one you guys want to check out. And of course, speaking of engineers, we are in the middle of a Radio Memphis Road Crew Radio Series interview about you by Ken Barr Films right here in Radio Memphis. And today we are talking to engineer extraordinaire Mr. Robert Scoville. How are you doing, honey?
I'm doing good, dude. What's up?
So, I just,
by the way, if you ever mention the name Mike Wagner,
yes,
Michael Wagner,
yes,
you should always precede it with the great Michael Wagner.
The great.
I'm gonna throw that out there.
Okay. See, I need you in my life because I don't know those rules, and you know what lane to stay in. So, how is it that we do? How is it that we mention, other than the fact that he's great, he's fantastic? You know, I got to, and it's been some time, you know, and I got to spend some time on air with him, and you know, and we started his story from the from Don Dock and Stofa. That's where we started with him.
Yeah.
And so,
you know, it's funny, you know, when I got to work with Alex, you know, the first tour I did with him was, which was 84, 85. Michael Wagner was the producer and engineer on that record and for that tour, so. He was always out. We kind of got to know each other. He was helping me out a lot at that point, and I mean, he's just the greatest guy.
He is. He's a fantastic guy. You know, of course, big shout
and
out to
super talented engineer.
Very much so. Very much so. And of course, you know, his thing also too. You know, him reaching back because he does his seminars. You know, and he does the sound stuff, yeah. and things like that. And what he's doing is that he's bringing in, you know, for the clinics and stuff, he's bringing in, you know, indie artists and stuff like that to have that opportunity, you know, to be the subject, yeah. you know, to his clinics. And so not only is he getting to, you know, pass the torch, you know, to the up up-and-coming engineers and things like that, he's actually getting to put his hands, you know, on some new up-and-comers as far as, you know, music and stuff. And so everybody's getting the best of both worlds with him on that.
Yeah, he's passing the torch on to those bands, too, believe it or not.
I mean,
they're learning how to do it, I dare say, the right way, but in a really, really good way, a really meaningful way.
Very much so. Now, but back to you.
Yeah, back to
you, man, because you're fantastic, too, and that's why I'm on the phone with you. You know, and those of you that have tuned in, I'm talking to Robert Scovel, and we're having, like, way too much fun, man. I mean, we're going to be giggling through this whole thing for the rest of it, I have this feeling. Okay, we talked about, you know, you coming in and, you know, and ultimately kind of getting your break, you know, with Shooting Star. You know, and things like that. Now, one of the beautiful things from that point, you know, you wind up, you know, ultimately you get exposed to all of these, you know, cool and up-and-coming bands. And I say this to all of you because the thing with you guys is that when you talk about these names and you're like, oh, and, you know, it was Journey was there and so-and-so was there, so-and-so was there. And it's like, but you guys were around them when they were really getting their foothold into the music industry. And so you were kind of riding the rocket with them, you know, while they were doing that stuff.
Well, we certainly got to them at the peak of the rocket ride for them. I mean, Journey in 1981, 82.
Right.
I don't think you could have got any bigger than they were at that point. I mean, they and we've kind of talked about this the last time we spoke. You know, they were another one of these bands that took the touring machine and moved it up a whole another rung on the ladder. I mean, they just, you know, refined the whole process. And, you know, we're still benefiting from that today, you know.
Right. And
it is an amazing thing.
It is an amazing thing. One of the moments now, okay, so we backtrack a little. You wind up picking up that, and from that point, you know, from Shooting Star and stuff, I mean, where do you show up? Where do you go?
Well, I worked with them for quite a period of time, and, you know, was able to kind of do some, you know, just lots of work with them around the country. And like I said, picked up a lot of this stuff. But at some point, obviously, they're going to shut down and, you know, take breaks and go on to other things. And it was kind of up to me at that point to try to find other work.
Right.
And through one of those connections, I think the next thing I took, funny enough, was a drum roadie gig working for John Mellencamp.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So a friend of mine named Bob McCutcheon, who's always been in and out of my life for my entire life, got me the gig with Mellencamp. And then I went and did that for the Uh-Huh tour, which had, you know, that was the Pink Houses record.
That is so crazy. Wow. Okay.
I mean, just completely blew up. I mean, that was an incredible experience. And to get to work with Kenny was just the best thing ever. He's just one of the greatest guys I've ever been around.
Oh, fantastic.
So I did that tour, and then from there, I went on and picked up the Go-Go's. I went and worked for the Go-Go's for one entire tour as a monitor engineer.
Oh, okay.
Worked with a great friend of mine who was at front of house at that point, a guy named Ed Wynn, who recently passed away not long ago. But just a great guy. He'd worked with Joni Mitchell and a bunch of other stuff. He was just a fantastic guy.
So you're doing...
So I picked up the Go-Go's, did that whole tour, you know, just kind of kept it going through the 80s all the way up until the Alice Cooper gig in 1985. And that ended up being kind of a stepping stone into my next big chunk up the mountain.
Okay, I love the way you just kind of slid that in there, Robert. You know, no, see, if you have not figured anything out with me yet, we're not sliding into this because I want the gory details. And when we're saying the word gory and Alice and shock and rock and stuff, this is perfect. So back up for a second. So
all right, I put it in R.
Back up. So you get Alice Cooper. Now how does this gig show up in your world?
Well, you know, this at that point in Alice's career, you know, he had been away from the music industry a little bit. You know, he had been dealing, and I'm sure it's well documented, with all the substance abuse.
Yes.
Leading up to that point, and this was really his first big comeback tour. He was going to reestablish at this point. I mean, he was very healthy at the time. He's singing great. I mean, all of it was in place for him to really make his next big move in the industry. So,
wow.
He had always worked with this company out of Canoga Park, California, this big sound company called Electrotech.
Okay.
You know, remember earlier what I was talking about? There was, you know, three or four big companies that were kind of doing it. Electrotech was definitely one of them. They had kind of morphed from a company called TFA Electrosound, which was this big stalwart, you know, through the 60s and 70s and into the 80s for sure.
Wow, right.
And they had used them in the past, so they were going to use them again. And just so happened, I was working with Electrotech at that point. You know, that was the next sound company that I had kind of gone to work for and done a lot of work. And a gentleman named Ricky Farr and Pierre Destouge were running that company. And I was very, very close with both these guys. Pierre, as a matter of fact, Pierre was in my wedding. So,
oh, wow.
You know, I mean, this is family time, you know.
I got you.
And the Alice Cooper tour had kind of rolled across their desk, and Alice was looking for a front of house mixer, so they recommended me. I mean, it was just as simple as that.
Oh, really?
You know, I had been working with them for a long time, off and on, and they thought it was a really good opportunity for me. And I kind of played it pretty close to my chest at that point that I was a big Alice fan.
Yes.
As soon as I heard that had come through the door, I was like, "That's my gig."
You know,
everybody stand the frick back. That's my gig. Don't even think about asking for that gig.
It was so funny. And for those of you that have tuned in, I'm talking to Robert Scovel. When we started this interview, it started with, you know, ultimately, you know, you going, you know, and your mom, you know, taking you to this concert, and you know, and so, and now we've kind of, you know, kind of morphed into the future a little bit. And so we show up, and this opportunity is being presented to you, and you get to do this gig with Alice Cooper's group. So you get in there, and of course, this is ultimately where we finally talk about, you know, Ken Barn, and Putter, and you know, and everybody else that is involved, you know, Dan Stevenson, and everybody this is kind of like the core where I kind of really started. You know, I jumped in the middle of,
right.
I jumped in the middle of this part, and then my branches have gone out from that, and it's been a fantastic ride so far. So hearing how you kind of come into the fold and do this, you know, you wound up, you know, picking up the gig, and you had, Robert, a very special moment happen to you in the middle of this.
Yeah, I did, as a matter of fact, yeah. And, you know, to really put that in context, you had to understand how kind of near and dear the Alice Cooper thing was to my heart. I mean, like I said, I was a huge fan.
Right.
I mean, and I'm still a fan of those records today. I can go back and listen to, you know, School's Out, Billion Dollar Babies, you know, Killers, all of those records, and I have probably more reverence for them today.
Wow.
Than even I did then. I mean, the production and the writing, the engineering production, it's just phenomenal on those records. So to say I was a big fan would be an understatement. But, you know, I had this moment, you know, when we got on the tour, you know, I was looking at the itinerary, and sure enough, you know, on the itinerary, I see that we're going to play St. Louis. And not only that, we're going to play Kiel Auditorium. And that just happens to be the very place that my mom took me. I remember just having this moment of like, whoa, okay. You know, so, you know, I didn't really, you know, this thing that happened, I didn't really plan it, you know, per se, but I just took the opportunity to do it while I was at the show. So
right.
We're at the show, everything's set up, the show is going, we're probably, I don't know, 8 songs in, 10 songs in, something like that. And I'm, you know, sitting at the console, obviously mixing the show.
Right.
And at some point, I just got the urge. Russell Fisher was my assistant at that point. I said, Russell, you're going to take the console for one song, and I got to go do something.
In the middle of this?
Oh,
where are you
go
going?
To the bathroom or something. Must be really bad. I've never seen him leave the console. He must have to do this really bad.
Right.
So I turn it over to him, and I leave, and I marched right up to where I sat 13 years ago, or at the age of 13. It was probably about 13 years ago.
Wow.
And sat down and watched one song from up there and just kind of relived that 13-year-old's moment up there, you know.
Oh.
And it was, I don't want to sound all gushy here, but it was a little emotional
sound gushy.
For me.
Sound gushy.
It really was, because, you know, where I was at that moment versus where I was 13 years ago just seemed so impossible. It just seemed impossible. Like, that will never happen. I mean, it's fun to dream, but that will never happen. And there I was sitting there with it happening, you know, so
that
it was a big deal.
That gave me goosebumps. I got, like, butterflies in my I did. It just, I mean, see, I mean, like, I'm not even trying to kid about this. That's such a fantastic moment, you know.
Yeah,
it was. You know, it's a little surreal, you know.
It was, oh, my gosh, surreal in capital letters. Let me just try to reassure you. I mean, it was just an amazing experience to do that.
Oh,
and
wow.
That, you know, I don't know. I can't put it in. I probably can't put it into words how much it meant for me to do that.
Do you, well, apparently you did a fantastic job, and you were able to, you know, make some crazy cool things happen with that. And, you know, and everybody, you know, as far as that camp, you know, has had nothing but, you know, fantastic things, of course, to say about you of that. But
well, I appreciate that. They were great guys. I mean, for your listeners to try, I there's no way I'll be able to explain this, but to tour with somebody like Tom Hamlin, to tour with Cutter, it's like you wake up in the middle of a stand-up comedy routine every single day of your life. It's just the funnest thing you can ever possibly imagine.
Well, just so you know, we're gonna unleash Putter in spurts on here. I'll keep you clued in, sweetheart. You won't miss it. I'll make sure of that.
And just he's one of the funniest human beings I have ever met. I mean, just so much fun.
He is. He's a hoot. Now during this time period, you also had quite the fantastic moment happen where you were pulled and you wound up having to go and take care of another big band. You wound up having to
Are you referencing the Def Leppard thing?
I am. You're following me good. Mm-hmm.
Okay, good.
I am.
Well, that, you know, that's kind of what I was alluding to, because I don't think we talked about this the other day, but there's even an Alice Cooper connection to getting that gig.
And I was wondering, I was wondering about that.
It's a really, really meaningful one. It's probably, honestly, if there's probably one fulcrum point or one hinge point in my career where it went from just being at one level to a completely different level.
Sure.
This was probably it, you know, and I'll try to Reader's Digest the story here a little bit.
But oh, no, man. So, come on.
So the story goes like this. I'm out mixing Alice Cooper.
Okay.
And, you know, for this lengthy tour, and on this tour we have an opening act, and the opening act is Tesla.
Okay.
And they're managed by a company called East End Management. If you guys are really in tune with the business, you know who that is. That's Peter Mensch, Cliff Bernstein. I mean, if there's going to be a Mount Rushmore of managers, one of them is probably on it. I mean,
oh, wow.
The real deal.
Okay.
But they're managing Tesla at the time. Now, you got the other piece of the context you got to have here is this is about 1985. So Def Leppard has already done Pyromania.
Yes.
They had been on break for a couple of years, and Rick has had his accident.
Yes.
You know, so, where he's lost his arm. So, you know, who knows what's happening there? I mean, the word Def Leppard never even crossed my mind.
Right.
But these guys, East End Management, also manages Def Leppard.
Okay.
So we're on the tour, and Tesla's manager, i.e. Def Leppard's manager, is also out on the tour, and he's kind of hearing me mix every night, et cetera, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the other little piece of the sidebar you got to have is that they also manage Dokken.
Oh, okay.
And Dokken at this point is blowing up. I mean, they're doing really, really well at this point in their career. So we're coming toward the close of the tour. And, you know, I've been kind of pimping Peter, the band's manager, on getting the Dokken gig. I'm like, dude, you should let me do Dokken.
Really?
I could crush it. I could crush it.
I didn't know. I would not have guessed that about you. Okay.
Right. Yeah. We had gone to London. I think we had played Wembley with Alice or something. I don't remember exactly what it was. But Dokken was there opening for AC/DC. I got to go down, hang out with the guys a little bit.
I got you.
And of course, that kind of fueled it. I was thinking, oh man, I want that Dokken gig. I'm going to get that.
Okay.
So, unbeknownst to me during all of this, you know, Def Leppard is they're well into recording Hysteria at that point, and they kind of have a target out on the horizon of when they're going to put together a tour and go back out.
I gotcha.
And they're looking for a front of house guy.
I gotcha.
And every night on Alice, you know, I would record every night to cassette so I could review what I was doing, et cetera. And I'm going to continue to say this until I confirm it. Somehow, I don't know how, Joe Elliott with Def Leppard got a hold of one of my cassettes.
Oh, so you
I
and
don't
you
know
you,
who did it.
You don't
it might
know?
Have been Brian Wheat with Tesla. It might have been the photographer Ross Halpin. Those are my two big prime suspects. But somehow he got a hold of one of those tapes.
Oh,
and he had been just blistering Peter Mensch's ear about this is our guy. This is our guy. You got to get this guy.
Oh,
I mean, you know, and it was all about how I was handling vocals and backing vocals and guitars.
Wow,
and you got to get this guy. This is our guy.
Wow.
And Peter, of course, was out listening on the tour. According to the story, Peter was contacting Joe and going, are you sure this is the guy? I mean, I'm kind of hearing it out here. I'm not sure this is the guy for Def Leppard, you know. And I got to give praise to Joe Elliott. I mean, I got to give thanks to him. He really stuck to his guns and just goes, no, that's our guy.
Right. Wow.
I can hear it on this tape. And that's how I ended up getting the Def Leppard gig. I mean, you know, I remember getting home from the tour, and the phone, you know, we had message machines, obviously, at that point, and I saw a message from the number that was Eastern Management. And I remember just thinking, oh, this is it. I got the docking gig.
Yeah.
The docking gig. Pick up the message and call Peter back, and he's like, okay, so I want you to do Def Leppard. And I was like, Def Leppard?
What?
Really? Really?
I want to dock in.
I mean, I'm sure the disappointment in my voice was like, wow, you know. But I had no idea what was going on already.
But look what happened. But after that, look what happened with them.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, I mean, it was just a ridiculous tour, you know. And I, honestly, I was able to do some things sound reinforcement-wise that I had always dreamed about doing. And, you know, I mean, it just was a perfect storm of things that happened there. You know, just a perfect storm. But, again, you know, it kind of reinforces that concept of when opportunity knocks, you got to be ready.
You got to be ready.
Start preparing once opportunity.
You didn't even know, you didn't even realize where that particular one was going to take you. You know,
no, I didn't.
And look what wound up happening. So
yeah, I mean, it was just a magical time. No doubt.
That is so crazy. So you know, and of course, with that, then you know, gigs get bigger. You know, artists, you know, get bigger. Everything gets crazy. Ooh. And
expectations get bigger. Let me tell you that.
Well, okay. And yeah, you'll tell me, you know. So you know, everybody starts beating down on your door, you know, to, you know, because, you know, what you do as far as, you know, front of the house, you know, it's very, you know, it's very specific, you know, and it's, look, you're selling them to the crowd, man. You know what I mean? You're making sure that.
Well, yeah. And we were, you know, on that tour, we were doing something that had never been done before, especially in that genre.
Okay.
You know, and certainly at that scale where we were doing it in the round, you know, in arenas. I mean, we definitely put the stick in the spokes there, kind of the touring machine, because we were going to go out and do it different than anybody had ever done it before.
Right.
And, you know, East End had kind of approached a couple of other mixers about doing it, and they all turned it down. They just said, I don't think that's going to work. I don't want to go out and do that. And I absolutely said, I can absolutely do this. We can make this work. That's
okay.
You've got to be patient with me and let me, you know, experiment here a little bit. We get the right company and we get to get everything right here. This can absolutely be done.
That's not how it went. You told me, you're like, yeah, I can do it. Sure can.
Well, I can. Yeah, I mean, I was sure I can do it. When other engineers were sure they couldn't do it, you know. So I think that's kind of what separated me. I think combination of that and Joe's, you know, positivity about me being the guy.
Oh, absolutely.
Deal for me.
Absolutely, and I kid with you, because, you know, when we were talking about this on the other night on the phone, I was telling you, I said, you know, everybody's, you know, everybody that I talk to with you guys is got this certain stance of, you know, can you do this? Well, yes, I can. And then later on, it's like, okay, how am I going to do this? And
well, there was definitely some of that. I was definitely faking it till I make it a little bit, just a little bit there, you know, because it was uncharted territory. I mean, you know, I don't think you can be 100% positive when you're uncharted.
No, but you said something very, very eloquent to me, and you told me this. You said that you guys are the type of people that do not run, you know, from things like that. You run to it, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The people that make it really, really far in this end of the work, for sure, have that kind of warrior spirit, kind of warrior mentality, where you run toward challenges. You don't play them.
That is
no doubt about it. As a matter of fact, you're out looking for them. You know,
no doubt. Currently, you are and have been for many years. You are responsible for front of the house for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. How did that come up?
Well, that's an interesting one in that. You know, I came off of Rush, because they were just closing down at that period of their career.
See, I can't even really believe. Hold 2 seconds. Forgive me. I feel like I have to say prayer for no. I'm saying it this to like the man upstairs, because how can I overgrow? How can I like step over Rush? I love love. I love some prog. I love Neil Peart.
Yeah, that's sacrilege.
That's okay. Okay, all right. Tom Petty. Okay, Tom is here in the now. He's here. You're with him now. Okay, like, let's back this bus up. Rush. I'm sorry. Rush. You know, Rush is the funny thing about progressive music, and you know, and for those of you that have tuned in, I'm talking to Robert Scoville as part of the Radio Memphis Road Crew Radio Series interviews that we do here in Radio Memphis. You know, we do a prog show here on Radio Memphis too, right before I do Metal Mondays, and you know, and we always joke, we always have this thing about, you know, progressive music, and you know, it was always, you know, for the longest, and you know, when I make the statement, like, remember how it was always like the bastard child, you know what I mean, and it was, you know.
And it was
hard for it to get out, and it was hard for it to, you know, for people to really kind of accept and understand. Some of the most incredible artists, the incredible musicians, the most talented people, you know, are part of this style, you know, and you know, and here's Rush. I mean, you know, they literally took the underground scene. They took the epitome of winning over everybody, you know, without the assistance in the beginning. You know what I mean?
Well, gosh, I mean, if you look at Rush when they first entered, I mean, I remember seeing them on Don Kirshner's rock concert in 1973, 74, something like that. And you talk about being on the edge. I mean, they were edgy. I mean, that was like, woo. I mean, you as a kid, you kind of go, boy, that might be too edgy for me.
Yeah, well, as an engineer and everything else, but you also have, you know, a drummer. Okay, you see his stuff. I mean, what do you do? Where's your mind at?
Well, you know, and this is something that's not talked about very often, but I'll kind of go there.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that Rush's music always did for me, and I think I innately knew this before I ever really understood what a producer did and what an engineer did, all this thing.
Right.
There was something in their music that was absolutely free, you know, in terms of its spirit. Like, the, you know, especially Neil's drumming, you know, there was just something about that where he played things that were just so out of left field.
Right.
And, you know, as I started to mature into my career a little bit, and I started to really have reverence for that and really understand it, in that he played all of the things that a normal producer would edit out or talk them out of playing during takes.
And
I just remember being such a free spirit. And as a drummer, you know, it was always just so cool to kind of mime that and try to play that.
Yeah.
And good, I remember having arguments at times. You know, you always have these arguments. Who's the greatest drummer? Blah, blah, blah,
oh, jeez. All right, so who is
and
it?
And, you know, talking with guys who say, well, I could play all of his stuff. And I used to always say, that's not the point.
Mm-mm.
Whether you can play his stuff is not the point. The point is this. Would you play that stuff given a blank slate?
Yes.
Would you play it? If you had nothing to play and these were the parts you were trying to play, is that what you would play? And I submit to you, you would not. That's what separates him from all the other drummers that are out there.
Wow.
Especially in that genre. I mean, it was just an amazing, amazing time. And, you know, Rush is one of those bands, I mean, either you are a fan or you are not a fan. there's no middle ground Rush fans.
Yeah,
you know?
It's one or the other.
The people that are true fans, I mean, are fanatical about it. And I was one of those kids, no doubt about it. I was absolutely one of them. I had seen every Rush tour up until the time I had gone to work for them. I mean, and for every bit that the Alice gig was the dream gig, you know, the fantasy gig, Rush was just as much that
I was getting ready to say
my fantasy gig as a mixer.
So
no doubt about
it. I was getting ready to say, because I mean, if you were such a fan and you went to all the shows and stuff, and here you are, you're showing up, and you get to work that. Now, which shows did you wind up working with them?
I did everything Presto through Test for Echo.
Really?
So, you know, really the second half of their career, kind of their rebirth. Again, they're kind of rebirth.
Okay. Okay. Man.
And they were just sensational during that period. I mean, they're just their performances were just awesome.
See?
I mean, it was just so good.
See? You're getting all excited talking about it all over again.
I am. Well, especially that gig. I had such an affinity for that gig. And you know, and the thing that just glues that whole thing together is the three guys are just the greatest guys you are ever going to meet in your life. I mean, they're just, they're three of my favorite people I've ever met.
Oh, wow.
In my life.
Wow. And so you had a fantastic time with them.
Those tours were without a doubt the funnest and the most technically challenging.
Of course.
It was great.
Of course.
There was just this camaraderie out on that tour. Unlike most tours. I mean, it was a very, very special time.
Wow. See, that's awesome stuff. You wound up, okay, so we paid homage because I was like, I'm not stepping over Rush. Sorry. I grew up, you know, with a little drumming and stuff like that too. And, you know, if you were to tell me, so you start talking some of that, I mean, we'd be on the phone till tomorrow. Okay.
So I could do a day on Rush, no problem.
See, all right, we're already in the same boat, man. You wind up getting done with them, and so you got Tom Petty that's in the wings. How does this come into play?
Well, funny enough, you know, Tom's management had been kind of recruiting me for a little while, and I was a little, it was one of those weird things. I was a little indifferent to the gig, and the connection, like the way I got connected to it, was. A guy named Mike Shipley had mixed and engineered Let Me Up, I've Had Enough, that record for Tom Petty.
Okay.
And, you know, Mike Shipley was engineered all and mixed all of the Def Leppard stuff. Him and Nigel Green, they did all of those records. So, you know, I got to know Mike over time and worked closely with him for a lot of times. And, I mean, he singly had an incredible influence on my approach and my technique and my listening chops, etc. He had a big influence on that.
Wow.
But him doing that Petty record, I think he kind of put the bug in their ear about me.
Ah.
And they started kind of recruiting me. And like I said, I was a little bit indifferent to it. I knew who Tom Petty was. I won't say I wasn't a fan. I was a fan, but just kind of a distant fan. I didn't really get it, you know.
I got you.
Honestly, in hindsight, I didn't really get it.
Okay.
The records that Iveen and Yakis put together in the early 80s, sonically were incredible. I remember just having kind of some reverence for the sounds of those records. They just sounded unbelievable.
Well, sure.
But, you know, the musical thing, like I said to you the other day, you know, unless music's coming out of the PA system, I'm not really interested.
There it is.
And in that situation, musically, I wasn't really in tune with what they were doing or what they were going after. Yeah.
I got you.
Fast forward up to, you know, the time when Wildflowers was coming out for Petty, and you know, I was on break, on a hiatus, and was looking for a gig, and I just thought, okay, maybe I'll, you know, I knew Mike had done the record. I'll call Mike, see what he thinks.
Right.
So I called Shipley up and asked him about it, and he goes, dude, take the gig. Dude, take the gig. He goes, it's going to be the greatest thing you ever worked on in your life. Just take the gig. I was like, really? Okay. All right. So I took the gig, and, you know, we got into rehearsals in that very first week. And I remember, you know, the thing that really struck me in that first week of rehearsals, we were there, rehearsed 4, 5, 6 days in a row, and I don't think I heard them play one single Tom Petty song the entire time they were there.
Okay.
And I was thinking, because that was so counter to what I had done in the past. I mean, to contrast that against Rush or Def Leppard, you could do weeks of rehearsal with them and never hear anything other than Rush or Def Leppard music.
Right.
I mean, the focus was singular there. So this was just such a contrast to that. And I remember walking out, and you know, walking out of there just thinking, wow, they do that so effortlessly. Like, it was apparent right off the get-go that their retention of music and all of their influences over their entire career was just breathtaking. You know, I mean,
wow.
They were so fluent at it. And, you know, not long after that, I started to get it. I started to realize where all of Tom Petty's music came from.
Oh.
Like, you started seeing the threads of it, you know, because they were doing this. And, you know, playing these old songs and these, you know, these kind of, you know, legendary songs was their way of connecting musically and then moving into Tom Petty stuff. I saw that very, very clearly there.
Okay.
And that really set the hook in me, you know. And then all of a sudden, I started thinking, oh, my gosh, this I might be working for America's greatest rock band here. This might be the greatest band in America right now.
And you just fell right into it.
I fell right into it. And as luck would have it, you know, I'll call this luck. You know, Tom and I hit it off pretty good right out of the gate. We actually have very, very similar senses of humor.
Oh, nice.
And it played really well into my role.
Then I need to get to know him too, because if that's the case, man, I've got him figured out.
Oh, dude, he's got the driest, coolest wit. If you have to be paying attention, but if you're paying attention, you will be on the floor laughing. On the floor.
Good.
And you know, he does it sometimes during the shows, and nobody gets it but the people that are standing around and have been around him for years. You know, it's so funny.
That is absolutely so insane and crazy. You wind up, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to take another quick commercial break, and I got another song in, because we're I'm wanting to kind of get into all the stuff that you're getting into now too, and you know, and there's, and it's one of those things where, you know, you're, you know, Robert, your career has spanned so many different things and so many different acts. And I mean, and we've talked about some very, very specific ones, because they were kind of, you know, pinnacle points, you know, and fulcrum points, as you put it, you know, to where it kind of shot you to other places. But you know, over the course of time, yes, you mean, you got to work with some pretty insane, you know, people and pretty, you know, infamous groups and stuff. You know, of course, we hadn't even touched in on stuff that you did for Prince, and we hadn't even touched in, you know, stuff that you did with Matchbox 20, you know, and things like that.
Yeah.
You wind up, you know, showing up and ultimately being a part of these groups and these artists' worlds, where, you know, the presentation that they give, I should say, you know, to the audience, you know, really, really kind of falls on your shoulders, just to make sure that, you know, everything is there. And one of the things that ultimately that it kind of leads into is, you know, your quest, you know, your ultimate quest of, being the mixer, you know, and being the engineer, and you take it even further. So we're going to get back into that. But let me, for those of you that are tuned in, you're hanging out with me, D, Radio Memphis Around the World. We got a very special interview with Mr. Robert Scovel, engineer, and it is part of the Radio Memphis Road Crew Radio Series, brought to you by Ken Barr Films right here. I need to play a quick commercial break so that, you know, I don't get in trouble.
I wouldn't want to get you in trouble.
I kind of know the people that run this stuff too, man. But you know, I'm trying to run a tight ship here, man. Help me out.
You and me are going to meet for a martini someday, and it's going to get out of control.
Shut up. All right, you guys, hold tight for me. You're hanging out with me, D, right here in Radio Memphis Around the World. And that's a little Kara single band for you right here on Radio Memphis. You're tuned in to Radio Memphis Around the World with me, D. That is Wide Open, and that is the title track off that album, Wide Open, right here on Radio Memphis. All right, you guys, you've been hanging out with me. We are in the middle of a Radio Memphis Road Crew Radio Series interview right here on Radio Memphis, and we have been talking to Mr. Robert Scovel, engineer extraordinaire. How you doing, honey?
Doing good.
Riding it out. Well, riding
I'm talking
it out.
To my friend D.
I know, right? See, when this is all said and done. And by the way, that martini double dirty.
Got it. How did I know that you were a double down and dirty girl?
Double dog, dirty, done, cheap, all of it. Man.
Come on, just bring it.
You're on, man. I'm holding you to it, baby. I am. All right. So we've been having fun all afternoon, and you know, we've been getting into your world and your mind and kind of how you got started. And of course, you know, we talked about, you know, we left off with you doing stuff with Tom Petty and all the other ones. Now, what's funny is that, you know, you've been doing the Tom Petty gig for how long? You've been doing it for a long time. You know, it's been a minute.
Yeah, coming up on 25 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and so
I had one little break in the middle of it where I didn't tour with him for one tour. I was kind of committed to staying home and being with my kids and my family during that period.
But, well, sure.
Every tour through that period, for sure.
Absolutely. Now, of course, while you're not, you know, and it's not like they tour the entire time. So, and of course, while you're not working with him, you're able to, you know, work with other artists. And you know, did you find that as time went on, and I mean, everybody was kind of rapping on your door with you've got to help us with this sound, or you've got to help us with this presentation, and you know, did you realize that that's what everybody was kind of going to you for?
I don't know if I was acutely aware of it, honestly. I mean, I just, you know, maybe naively, I don't know, but I think it's kind of the right way to think anyway. Just kind of felt like, well, I'm doing good work. They want me to come over and help them and do some more good work. You know, it was just really that kind of simple. There was really no, I mean, I really tried not to overthink it, you know. I mean, because, you know, it's kind of a trap. I mean, you can fall into that trap out here really, really easily, where you kind of, you know, in a kind of a weird way, you become who you work for.
Right.
You know, that becomes your identity, and it's hard to kind of keep your own personality in things. And you know, I had it kind of put to me very early. And I, actually, when I was working with Def Leppard, you know, one of the first people I ever had try to put this mindset across to me was Mutt Lange. At the time, you know, the hysteria thing was going on, and I didn't really get to meet or hang out with him all that much during that period, but the times I did, it was very much like, I hate to say it, kind of like words from the burning bush. I mean, when this guy spoke, he was like, ooh, pay attention, you know?
Right.
And, you know, at that point in my career, I was trying to make some inroads as a producer as well. I wanted to produce music. You know, I was just getting ready to open up my own label. I had my own studio going here in Arizona.
Wow.
And one of the best pieces of advice he gave me was, look, you have to be yourself. You can take all of this influence and use it, but ultimately you've got to find your voice through your engineering.
Perfect.
And he says, you've got to be you. All the other people are taken. You know, and I just remember that really, really stuck with me over my time of trying to find out what my voice is, you know, as an engineer, and, you know, what my sound is, and all of these things, and try to put an identity with it.
Right.
And to take us all the way back forward now, I think that started to pay off during that period of my time.
Mm.
You know, after I'd been with Petty for a little bit, you know, kind of I think certainly with Petty, I think the people that were kind of following me, and I mean this from management and bands and stuff, started to realize, hey, he's not a one-trick pony.
Right.
You know, he's not just a metal guy or not just a prog rock guy.
Right,
He could also do Petty and do it great. You know, so that, honestly, at the end of the day, that was one of the bigger compliments I think I ever kind of got in my career, was just to be able to be accepted as somebody who could come in and present any kind of music,
mm-hmm.
and do it really eloquently and really comprehensively.
That's a very smart move. It was a very smart move, you know, and just show the diversity of, as far as, no matter what's, you know, placed in front of you, you know, and that's the biggest thing. So, just out of curiosity, you know, as time rages on, and, you know, and you're starting to get really pulled in on some fantastic projects, you wind up doing some stuff for Avid Technologies, and you are very responsible because of, you found your sound, you found your, you know, or your identity, you know what I mean? I should say it's more like your identity and how you identify with, you know, all the moving parts that you know you're working with. And the funny thing with you, Robert, is that, you know, you got started in the industry when there wasn't that much to work with, okay? And
right.
so you know, it's the epitome of when everybody wants to know how to do something, and they want to know it right then and there, and they want to know the hard part and everything. It's like, okay, look, I still need for you to know 1 + 1 = 2, and I need for you to really, really master this. So, you know, you've come up, you grew up, you know, in the sound technology industry. You know, you grew with it, you grew up with it along the way, and you know, you've been able to kind of really plug in. And one of the things that you do is that you're the senior market specialist, you know, focusing pretty much on, you know, the live sound, live console, and recording efforts and stuff. How did they come to you and go, hey, you're our guy, we need you? How did yeah. this work out?
Well, it's honestly a really interesting story. And again, it kind of plays to that concept of networking, and, you know, my dad taught me this when I was a kid, you know, be careful whose toes you step on.
Mm-hmm.
They might be connected to the ass. You have to kiss them.
There it is.
So, you know,
and
you know, it's like you kind of take every meeting that you do with somebody kind of seriously,
mm-hmm.
and hold on to it, you know.
Absolutely.
And, my path to DigiDesign at that time, and then Avid, was a direct result of something like that. Before I was mixing Alice Cooper in the 80s, another one of these tours that I picked up was this artist named Laurie Anderson.
Okay.
You know, kind of a very eccentric kind of a art theater, art rock kind of thing. I mean, it was really, really cool.
Right.
And I was mixing on that, and a gentleman named David LeBolt was the keyboard player in the band. And as luck would have it, just the tour went on. He and I actually got kind of tight. We were hanging out a lot together. You know, I got to know his wife. I wasn't married at the time, but we were always hanging out together on tour and stuff, you know. And so that kind of tour, you know, how do I want to put it? Kind of during that tour, you know, we had always been kind of talking about, boy, it'd be great if you could do this.
Right.
Why is this designed so poorly? Or, you know, all of these things, because he was very technically minded as well. And that was always kind of a point of conversation for us at some point during the day, it seemed like. So that tour kind of ended. And as a lot of tours like that do, we kind of went our separate ways. And, you know, even though you're very, very tight and close on a tour, you can finish that tour and go away and never talk to each other again. I mean, it's just part of the journey. You know?
Well, sure.
So this was, you know, mid-80s. Now fast forward up to about 99, something like that, around 99, 2000.
Okay.
David has gone on and played keyboards for a lot of other people. He had gone on to do Billy Joel and
right.
a bunch of other things. He had gone on to some really, really great stuff. And at some point, he had gone to work for DigiDesign.
Okay.
And saw them through all of the big changes and the big developments in Pro Tools. He helped drive a lot of that. He held a pretty high position at the company and was helping to drive all that.
I gotcha.
So 1999 rolls around. I'm pretty sure it was 99, if memory serves me. And the phone rings one day. And I don't recognize the number.
Of course.
Answer the phone. Hey, Rob, it's Dave LeBolt. I mean, I haven't spoken to the guy in 15 years.
Oh, wow.
Hey, it's Dave LeBolt. Hey, David, how you doing, man? We kind of catch up a little bit. Hey, I know you've been working at DigiDesign. Hey, I've been watching you mixing the tours. You know, it seems like things are going really well, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
He goes, hey, I'm thinking about trying to push a live sound console initiative into DigiDesign. We want to do a live sound console. Would you be interested in coming up and working on it?
Really?
Yeah, okay.
Well, sure.
But, you know, I mean, I'm kind of being flippant about it. But, you know, I mean, I actually kind of pulled back and really gave it some thought. And because I don't know if I totally saw how much it would impact my touring at that point. But I saw it as kind of an opportunity. Because in the initial days of it, I was just going to be this kind of, oh, man, I don't even know how to describe it, kind of a super consultant. On this
Well, thing. Yeah.
I mean, I was at the very first conceptual meeting for the Venue product line that came out of there, and we kind of I tell this to people all the time. I so wish I had the napkin drawings that we had from our first meeting.
I love it.
Kind of drawing out this thing. But, you know, that kind of went on. My touring kind of continued on, and I kind of worked in the background as a consultant for them.
Okay.
But the thing that was always kind of in my mind, and I don't know why I've carried this in my mentality for a long time, but it's been a part of me for a long time, is that, you know, if I'm going to get into this business, I don't want to just be quote unquote successful.
Right.
I want to be significant. I want to have something that I do raise up this industry a little bit and change it for the better.
I got you.
I kind of said at some point here not long ago in an interview, you know, that if I get to the end of my career and I've been mixing for 40 years and I do 5,000 shows, if that's it, my career's been a failure.
Oh, no.
It's been an absolute failure.
No.
Because I had so much opportunity along the way to actually change the industry and raise it up a little bit.
I got you.
And I think part of that feeling or part of that drive comes from being around, like I said earlier, the people in the Alice Cooper camp
right.
who have changed the touring mechanism. You know, I saw them do it. I saw part of what they were doing and how much impact they had on the touring mechanism. To work with companies like Electrotech,
right.
who were changing the industry. They were developing things that were going to raise up the industry to the next level, et cetera. So
right.
I was always kind of around that kind of innovative,
mm-hmm.
leading edge thing, you know?
Absolutely.
And I wanted to be there.
Absolutely.
I wanted to do something that would do that. And I think I saw my opportunity to do that working for DigiDesign and Avid, you know?
See? That's perfect. That's absolutely perfect. And it's beautiful because, you know, that's another full circle moment for you, Robert. You mean, you realize that too, right?
Totally. Totally.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you're that kid, you know, at Supertramp, you know, staring at this beautiful board going, I want to do this, and not having a clue of what was going on. And, I mean, and look at what you're doing now, you know, and, you know, yeah. you're helping, you know, set some standards, you know, you're helping, you know, raise the bar. You're also, and one of the things, you know, and as I told you when we were on the phone, you know, I got into some of your blogs, you know, and stuff that you do. You have a couple blogs out that you do for Avid, you know, and you've
yeah.
also got... you've also got some blogs out on, I believe it's a PSL, PSL.com or something like that. There was a couple.
Yeah, those as well as some video blogs on my YouTube channel. I've been doing a video blog on this Petty Tour of every day, every show day.
Oh, wow.
Video episode from it. So.
And you've been putting stuff up. And it's so, what's so beautiful about the stuff that you're putting out is that you really are giving back to people going, look, this is it. You know what I mean? You're not hiding anything. You're sharing everything that you know. You know, you're sharing all of your tips and tricks. You know, you're sharing those moments. And you are a fantastic writer, by the way, because, you know, one of the things I think I got into was, I think one of the blog posts that you did was on one of the sites was Living the Dream, you know, and you go into this description of, you know how it goes, you know, it's a wonderful, it's a perfect show, everything is great, the lights are dim, everything is wonderful, and all of a sudden, they kick back on, and then there's no sound, you've been there, and then you wake up. I'm like, oh my God, he just sat there and described like this total PTSD, it was the PTSD moment for a roadie, you know what I mean,
it is
what you were describing, which was beautiful, you know,
yeah,
very...
It's the roadie dream, we've all had it, for sure.
working
in these high stress situations.
And you refer back and you're like, and you're naked and everybody, the band and everybody's looking at you and they're wanting to know where's the sound and where is it, you know, and you're like, oh, you know, and so, and then you go into a lesson or you go into something and it was very beautifully done. And you know, and I've been able to spend some time on a lot of the things that you've got out there. And, you know, you have been for the longest time continually trying to impact, you know, those that are interested in this business. And I mean, and ultimately this kind of, for us coming full circle, you know, with our interview, I mean, this is what this was all about. I mean, I wanted people to hear you, and I wanted people to hear your story. I wanted to hear people, you know, let people hear that you're a real dude. You know, it's just one of those. It's like, yeah, you know, it's, you know, this is how I got started, and this is what you know, why I kept going, and this is, you know, this is what I did, and you know, this is what it was about, and you know, and you know, and it was, you know, these things take time. One,
I mean, if you know the whole story, then it can kind of make sense. I think for people that would just browse by it,
right?
See it honestly, I mean, to be totally truthful about it, it can look vain at times. It can look like vanity out of control. But really, I mean, from the bottom of my heart, all it is me saying to everybody, you want to come up and have a look around? I mean, that's all that's happening there, you know? And it's just my way of paying that forward. I swear to you, it is.
You know what? Because somebody actually grabbed your hand and pulled you up and let you look around.
Yeah, it's just my way of... I know what that did for me, and I just want to give that feeling to somebody else. I mean, it's just as simple as that. Don't overthink it, folks.
Don't overthink it at all. One of the other things, you know, before you and I get to finish up, you are going to tell me about some very, very cool stuff that you are working on right now. And it was to the tune of something that was called the virtual sound check.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of that, you know, that's the item I think that will be my contribution to the concert industry and to the
okay.
industry.
Okay.
You know, I think that's part of what I saw in that opportunity at Avid was to be able to bring that concept to fruition through one of their products. Because it's something that I actually started working on in the early 90s, believe it or not. You know, really the Tom Petty gig was the impetus to start working on this concept.
Okay.
And I'll try to lay it out here so it doesn't sound so mysterious.
Okay.
But, you know, I kind of developed this idea as purely as a survival mechanism while working with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers because, like, as I mentioned earlier, you know, in that first week, I mean, I never heard a Tom Petty song.
Wow.
You know, here I am trying to prep and rehearse and get ready for a major tour. I mean, this is going to be a big tour.
Wow.
And the light bulb came on very quickly that, man, we might make it all the way through rehearsals here, and I may not have even heard some of the songs we're going to do on opening night. You know,
what are you going to do?
And that was kind of a scary proposition, you know,
because
I wanted it to be great. I wanted to take care of it. And I wasn't in a position at that point to demand that the band do these songs. I mean, look, that's the one thing you got to say about the Heartbreakers. They've been doing all of these songs for 40 years.
Well, sure.
They know the songs. They don't need to rehearse them.
Right.
They're actually better at them when they don't rehearse them.
Right. Because they're going to overthink
they
it,
just
right?
Are. So, you know, you got to pay kind of homage and respect to that. So, just to kind of get back to it, you know, it was a way for me, ultimately the goal was to make a way for me to rehearse the songs at the console from the perspective of mixing it without putting the demand on the band being in there slogging through take after take after take of it. That was
okay.
the ultimate goal. That was the primary goal of it. So I kind of devised this way, and luckily at that time, you know, we were just coming into these very low-cost digital multi-track recorders.
Right, right.
So I was able to kind of leverage some of that technology and interface it in a very specific way for the mixing console so that when they were playing, I could record it. And then when they stopped playing, I could literally hit rewind and bring it back into the console in a position where it was exactly as if the band was playing again.
Oh, wow.
But I could just work an infinite amount of time on refining what I was doing.
Look at you.
So that was probably about 1994 that I really started developing that.
And okay.
Worked on it for 5 or 6 years, many, many different iterations of it with analog consoles and digital recordings, until I moved into the late 90s where I actually switched over from those digital multitracks to Pro Tools.
Right, right.
Doing that very thing. And, you know, the funny part of it is both the digital audio manufacturers and the, you know, Avid, and or I mean, DigiDesign at that point, once they found out what I was doing, they were like, "You're doing what?" I mean, they were just incredulous that I was using the technology to work that way, you know.
Of course.
But sure enough, it was working, and it was a really validated thing. Now, you know, I didn't show any of this to the artist. The way I was doing it at that point was I would come in and kind of do a virtual sound check early in the day, and then the band would show up, and we would do an actual sound check.
Well, say, what's really funny.
The advantages of all this start to really blossom once you start doing it and you start understanding what's happening, because what it allows you to do is, in a very meaningful way, work on the sound of the room that you're going to be performing in that night, because you're using the actual performance of the band. Like, when we get on tour and do it, we're using the previous night's performance in the next venue. So you have the freshest performance, it's at the actual show dynamic, and however it sounds right now in that building, you can rest pretty assured that's how it's going to sound tonight. So if it doesn't sound good now, it's not going to sound good tonight.
Mm.
And the flip side of it is, if you can make it sound really good right now, when the band walks up and starts playing live, it's going to sound really good then as well. So,
smart man.
Again, just to provide some context on it, the way this had always happened in the past is, you know, our engineers would come in with pieces of pre-recorded music, maybe it's their favorite CD, their favorite cassette, whatever, and play that through the PA and try to get the sound right. And then the band would come in and play with live microphones and et cetera, and you'd just try to mix it together and get it to sound right.
Right.
But the problem with it, over time, unlike the studio, the problem in live sound has always been the only time as a mixer you ever get to work on your craft, you get to improve your skill or refine your mix.
Mm-hmm.
Is when the band is on stage.
That's it.
Or there is an audience in the room.
That's it.
That's it.
That's it.
In the studio, you can rewind the tape as many times as you want and make these beautiful sounding records, etc. But in live sound, you only get 2 chances. And it's consequently, for people that are just coming into the industry, it's very hard to develop the skill to do that job.
Wow.
You know, you're going to have to go through a whole lot of bad sounding shows before you get to a good sounding one. And it just does not suit our industry well. You know, the shows need to be sounding better than they were at that point.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes. And you make a valid point and stuff, because, you know, as we all understand, you know, it's still touring, it's still the live gigs, you know, that's making this industry go round. You know,
and it is certainly today. That is without question true today.
You know, and that's a very, very important part. That's an extremely important part, sweetheart. I've had so much fun with you this afternoon.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to do this. This is so much fun.
Are you kidding?
Can we do it every Saturday?
Well, you know what? You know what's really cool is that we're not done with you, because, see, here's the thing. You knew that there was a catch, and, you know, for $19.95 you can get this. Oh, but wait, there's more. Right. You know, we got these interviews that we do. We also do a road crew road tip, you know, that I actually do on Metal Mondays, Monday nights, and all the different guys. You know, you can even do one if you know, for about 20 minutes, you know, you give a road tip, whether it's for the road, for the studio, whether it's on stage, you know, just for, you know, for our bands and stuff like that. Uh-huh. And we've been kind of inching, and we've been kind of talking about some other things that are coming down the pike, and I haven't really kind of gone into it, and I hadn't really kind of mentioned mentioned it, but you know, for some reason, just because you've been on the phone with me all afternoon, and I just feel the need that because I want you to be inspired to know that we're not done with you. We do have some special programming that's going to be going into place, and that's about as far as I'm going to go with that. It's coming rapid and it's coming soon, that will give opportunities for individuals to get together and, oh, I don't know, talk to a radio host and do round tables and things like that. So I can only be as discreet as possible about that, but if it wasn't that obvious to you, we'll talk later.
Okay, sounds good. That sounds like conversation for martinis.
It is, and it's going to be. I'm holding you to that. What's your big plans? You got anything that you're gearing up for?
No, actually, I'm just sitting right now at the base of Camelback Mountain, looking at the mountains, drinking iced tea, talking to my friend on the radio.
No.
That's about as far as we're going to go today. But no, we start the tour. We kick the tour back up again on Wednesday. We go back up to Vancouver, and then we kind of make our way down the West Coast. We got three nights at the Greek Theater in San Francisco, or Berkeley, I should say, and then three nights at the Hollywood Bowl. We're just about to wrap up the Petty Tour, though, but
good.
That's about it.
Good deal. Well, I'll tell you what, sweetie. We're gonna obviously keep in touch, and you and I are going to get on the phone, and we're gonna mastermind a couple of other things as well. If there's anything that we can do for you guys here at Radio Memphis, you definitely need to let me know.
By the way, the people should know that the big building in Memphis, the FedEx Forum there.
Yeah.
I said this in one of my video blogs recently. I think that's the best sounding arena in the United States right now.
Wow.
Fantastic sounding arena.
Wow.
So Memphis, look it up.
Wow, that's a big statement. You guys heard it here first, right here. Very nice. Thank you.
We had a great show there. Great show.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Do it your afternoon, baby. Okay, we're going to talk soon.
Dee, we love you, girl. Take care of yourself. Thank you for the call.
No problem, honey. We'll talk. Bye-bye.
We'll see you. Bye-bye.
All right. Mr. Robert Scoville, what a total gem, man. I've had so much fun getting to know him and talk with him. He is, and obviously you guys have figured it out, because we've been on the phone for so much this afternoon right here in Radio Memphis Around the World. And this interview is all part of the Radio Memphis Road Crew radio series brought to you by Kenbar Films and brought to you by Radio Memphis, of course. And where we're able to, sit down with the industry pros and give you a little insight of, behind the scenes. And, he's done so much stuff. He's done so many amazing things, and he's doing so much more to really impact the sound industry, especially as far as the music industry is concerned. You can learn so much. If you go into your Google search and you type in Robert Scoville, so many different things come up. And if you get to those points, you can go to Avid, avid.com. He's got blogs on there. The PSL, the PSL.com source, he's got blogs on there. Read his blogs. They not only are they absolutely entertaining, you do get something, you do learn, and he makes it to where, especially for those of you that are in the industry or those of you that are wanting to get into this industry, it's very relatable. And I was telling him the other night, I wound up sitting down in one of the sites that he's got a couple of blogs out, and it was like, next thing I know, man, it was like 3 hours later, I'm reading a saga. It was fantastic stuff. So you guys, stay tuned. You guys, we got more of these coming, and of course, I dropped a little hint on some things that are also going to be coming down the pike, for the Radio Memphis Road Crew radio series. And it's all because we want to be able to give back. We want to be able to have all of our artists and all of our entertainers and all our bands and stuff to have some insight. We want you to listen to these guys talk and listen to them tell their story. Not only do they tell you the fun stuff, man, they're going to give you some stuff, that you can use and you can take with you, so you don't want to miss that, all right? In the meantime, all right, let me play another song for you right here on Radio Memphis Around the World. We're going to do a little Vinyl Rain, take a little break, a little commercial break. I know I'm running kind of behind schedule on a couple things. We also have a rock block coming up from our Artist of the Month. Yes, Miss Adna. So you guys, you don't want to go anywhere. You've been hanging out with me, D, right here on Radio Memphis Around the World.
The proceeding was produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated and originally aired live on Radio Memphis. Any offers or advertisement contained may not still be valid. All rights are reserved, and copyright is held by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. For more, look for all the RMOD players at radio-memphis.com.